You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Wantok ingoa. E whakarongo ana koe ki te Wire maranga irirangi pōho mō tēnei rā, te rā tekau mā whitu o pipiri. Kia ora, you tuned into the Thursday Wire on 95 BFM with me, Justin Wong, and producer Louis McAllister for today, rāpare Thursday the 17th of June. E haere ake nei, coming up on the show today, we have our regular updates with Radio Adelaide's Zoe Canandes and the lead coordinating minister for the government's response to the Christchurch Attack Royal Commission, as well as the health and treaty negotiations minister Andrew Little. The Kaukapo recovery team's Bronwyn Jeans will be speaking to Louis on Kaukapo breeding for the 2021-22 season, and the Islamic Women's Council's Andrew Raman spoke about the counter-terrorism hui in Christchurch from Tuesday and Wednesday. And let us know what you think of the government's electric vehicle discount. We might have a quick chat on that. He aha whakaro, and on that subject, definitely let the team know what you think. Tukapā tuhi mai, the text number is 5395, or wai mai rane, the phone number is 309-3879. We will keep those lines on until 1. Ko wa e ware ware e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki e ne kōrero ano hei pakihere rokiroki maronga i te pai tuku tuku o irirangi pōho me haere ki 95BFM i rakati.com. And as usual, you can catch all these stories and more by podcasts and on the 95BFM website.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
This week, with the lead coordinating minister for the government's response into the Christchurch Attack Royal Commission, as well as the health and treaty negotiations minister Andrew Little, I asked him about the counter-terrorism hui, which was held in Christchurch earlier this week, and his thoughts on the controversial They Are Us movie. But I began by talking about the Crown's new strategy towards fast-tracking Takutai Moana claims, and I began by asking the minister, what is that?
We've had the legislation obviously in place for some time, and under the legislation, the Marine and Coastal Area Act, iwi and hapu and whānau had until April 2017 to lodge their claims. They could either lodge them with the High Court or lodge them with the government. Many lodged them with both, but the upshot was we have about 380-odd claims for parts of the coastline across all parts of New Zealand where various claims have been made. Both the High Court and, frankly, the government, the Crown, have been struggling to work out what is the best way to process all these claims. The High Court's been scheduling hearings. They've really only heard two significant cases on claims. They've got two more, I think, scheduled for later this year, but that is how slow it's going. Admittedly, these first two cases were covered off some important points of law that had to be clarified. But in terms of the Crown, we really haven't made a great deal of progress at all. And so we did a big review last year. Te Ara Whiti, the part of the government that's responsible for all of this, did this extensive consultation with iwi and hapu and whānau last year and got this overwhelming feedback that, a lot of the parties, they need more help, more resources to assist with their research and putting their case together. Secondly, that actually most of them want to engage with the Crown. They actually don't want to have to go through the court process. They prefer to engage with the Crown because they prefer a negotiation. But thirdly, the way we're going at the moment, it would literally take us nearly 100 years to get through all the claims. And they said that's just not good enough, and we need to have a much more expeditious process. So we said, as a response to that, okay, you know what, we're not going to require everybody to stand in an orderly queue. We will engage with all groups covering all parts of the coastline. We'll break the coastline into 20 sections, but we'll start to engage with all groups. Some are more ready than others, but obviously there's some who are not so. But we will engage with everybody. We'll add resourcing to it so people can get their research done, get their preparation done. This means that we can actually get through the claims as lodged. We expect anywhere between 10 and 20 years, which is certainly better than 100 years, but still, you know, for a lot of people, it's still a long time, but people are more accepting of that.
So basically, the change is instead of dealing who comes first, you're dealing with 20 sections at the same time.
That's pretty much it. You said in a few words what it took me about 5 minutes to say. That's right.
But how do you determine the importance of each section, though?
Well, that's the big challenge, and that's what the recent court case, it's called the Edwards case on a Whakatoia claim, a hapa from Whakatoia had made a claim. And the court went through what the legislation says and what was expected and how it was to be determined. They came up with this notion for the first time of shared exclusivity. So, you know, some claims are for exclusive rights, and the court was saying actually that's probably not going to be possible, but it certainly is possible to say of a particular area of coastline that multiple iwi or hapu have particular rights and interests in it, but only those groups that can establish they have those rights will have those rights, and they describe that as shared exclusivity. So I think that's a principle now that will become established.
Okay, moving on to my second topic for today, it's about the counter-terrorism hui in Christchurch that's concluded yesterday. Now the conference has ended, did it achieve what the government intended to be?
Yeah, by and large it did actually. It was always the beginning of a process, and this is it came out of the Royal Commission of Inquiry's recommendations. It said that as a country we need to lift our public discussion about national security issues, including about terrorism and counter-terrorism, and actually increase understanding, but also engage the community and engage all sorts or all communities, you know, faith communities, ethnic communities, particularly those, you know, who are vulnerable to the sort of terrorist attacks that we have seen here and see around the world. So in terms of getting the dialogue underway, look, I thought it was really good. I was there for the first day of it. I thought everybody there was really well engaged. I thought there were some excellent presentations and good panel discussions, good question and answer sessions. So from my point of view, from the government's point of view, very pleased with it. But we all accept that this is just the start. We plan to have these annually now, these sorts of engagements. But it's a start to that conversation and also to a spur to getting some scholarship going, some New Zealand scholarship on terrorism and counter-terrorism and national security threats.
Okay. Particularly on the first day of the conference, though, we have Juliet Moses from the Jewish Council making comments about Hezbollah and the Muslim community that led to a walkout. Did you, well, you weren't on the second day of the conference, but do you think it could have affected the atmosphere or the dialogue for the second day?
Well, what I did observe was that after that had happened, with the help of a bit of my Te Ahuriri tikanga, everybody stopped. Kaumātua said, look, you know, let's just stop and have a cup of tea. So we all stopped to have a cup of tea. There was a bit of dialogue, and we resumed after the afternoon tea session. And there was some, I think, very dignified presentations made, responses made from the Muslim community about what had just been said. And then that carried on. And then later we had the dinner at a different venue in town. And actually, you know, members of the Jewish community, members of the Muslim community, including those who were involved in the events of that afternoon, sat around the table and had kai together and spoke together and talked. And that was very much, I think, the spirit of the conference. The walkout was for a five-minute period of time. It allowed a bit of a breather, allowed some discussions to go on between people, and then the conference resumed, I think, with a sense of great dignity. And, you know, and as everybody said, and after that, after the events, said, look, this is all about us seeking a path to peace in our own land, and a land that has had its own troubled past. And I think that's the spirit in which people were there, and it was evident at the dinner on the Tuesday night. And the reports I've had is that it pretty much pervaded the sense of the conference yesterday.
Right, but looking back onto the comments, do you think it's inappropriate for Juliet Moses to make a comment about what's about Hezbollah when the conference is about counter-terrorism and extremism in New Zealand?
Yeah, look, she said what she said. She's going to have to reflect on whether or not that was the right thing and the right time to say that. I think what I would reflect on is that group of 300 people was probably the most diverse group on any major public policy issue that we've ever seen that had been brought together. And they were talking about a reasonably controversial issue, which is, you know, a national security issue, and it's about terrorism and counter-terrorism. And the idea that we would get through 2 days and there wouldn't be disagreement, and look, there was plenty of disagreement, or for that matter, even inappropriate remarks. I don't think anybody ever expected that there wouldn't be disagreement, and there was. And the great thing was the way the conference attendees actually dealt with it, which was very constructive. And in the spirit of the whole gathering, the hui, which was actually, this is a pathway to peace. We're trying to find a way to ensure peace in our land.
Okay. The 2-day conference, I've got some conclusions out of that, saying online hate intensified after the attack. Muslim women don't trust authorities to keep them safe, and social media companies are still behind on how to handle or moderate online hate. So what can we see from the government after this hui?
So in terms of the social media platforms, there's the ongoing work of the Christchurch Call, and that will continue. And that is, look, that's an international problem. Every country is complaining that there's limited scope to take action unless you have the cooperation and agreement with the social media platform owners. So that work is ongoing. In terms of what we do in New Zealand, look, there is an ongoing program of work. I think the next major thing, which will be in the next couple of weeks, is that the Oversight Advisory Group, that was, again, another recommendation of the Royal Commission, we've now put that together. That group will have its first meeting, and that group will, I think, have a very important role to play to not only oversee us putting in place the recommendations, but actually the longer term and the deeper work of what is it that we're doing to ensure a greater sense of safety and security for all New Zealand citizens and residents, no matter how long they've been here and where they've come from.
Would this also influence the Intelligence and Security Act review?
The group will have an opportunity, if they want to have an input into that. I expect they will want to, and that review will get underway soon. It's a pretty thoroughgoing review. It's looking at the legislation. The security intelligence agencies and the police themselves have their own external reference groups in place. They had them in place to a greater or lesser degree before March 2019, but I think they've been prompted to make sure that the groups they've got meet the current expectations and current needs, and that stuff is happening at the moment too.
Okay, my final question, just a quick one on this. What do you think about the They Are Us movie?
Yeah, I just thought it was really badly handled, really badly timed. I think it's pretty clear that the Muslim community in Christchurch is still feeling very raw about what happened. And, in my discussions with many of the families in the last 6 months of the victims and the victims themselves is that they still need time to grieve and to come to terms. I think it's interesting the number of times in the conversations I had, people said, look, we've been doing all our grief in public. We actually just need some time to ourselves and to grieve in our own way, in our own private sort of way. And I think, then organising a movie that puts more examination on it, I think was just really, really poor form by the producers. And, I think the reaction from the community has been the right one, but was actually predictable once you knew how they were feeling and had been feeling for some months.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
That was indeed Health Minister Andrew Little. Whakarongo ana koe ki te irirangi poho. You tuned into the Thursday Wire here on 95 BFM. Get in touch. Let me and Louis know what you think about all the topics, and especially on EVs, for later in the show. Tuka Patuhi Mai, text in on 5395, or why am I calling on 309-3879. We will be going on a quick break now, but after this, Louis talks to the Islamic Women's Council on their experiences at the counter-terrorism hui. The time is just past 21 past midday.
The majestic wonders of the ancient world. The pyramids at Giza. The cunning riddle of the Sphinx. But now one ancient secret has been solved by the good people at Bread and Butter. Their ancient grain sourdough uses heritage cereals, Khorasan, spelt and sorghum, and follows the age-old method of sourdough fermentation dating back to ancient Egypt. So it's great for your gut, tastes delicious, and is better for the planet. Ancient grain sourdough at Bread and Butter, Greylin, Ponsonby, and the Coast Plaza in Whangaparoa. Order online at breadandbutter.nz.
Seabiscuit's a wanker. Black Beauty's been checked out since 96. Farlap's dead and Australian.
But there are still some equine chums who know how to show you a bloody good time. Pony Ping Pong on 95BFM. Every Friday night, Matt and Aaron are here to blast open your weekend with a mix of mashdowns, candid convos, cheap shots, and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong. Friday, 9 to 11 p.m. only on 95BFM.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Louis, what have you got?
New Zealand's first annual hui on countering terrorism and extremism was held in Christchurch on Tuesday and Wednesday this week. The hui involved multiple speakers, including representatives from the Islamic Women's Council, who voiced concern over online hate towards minorities. I spoke with the Islamic Women Council's Anjul Rahman about the role of media in extremism and how government and technology companies should regulate this. I began by asking her about the key issues and demands her group outlined at the anti-terrorism hui.
I think in terms of the Islamic Women's Council session, the key factor was trying to get public servants to understand the ways that discrimination plays out for women that are trying to access services or having to deal with issues. And so we were asking that they try and understand what the impact is and then look at changing the way that they deliver services to ensure that, you know, that those services are accessible to everyone.
Do you think that at the moment enough is being done to deliver these services and to help Islamic women?
I think it's, you know, it's not just Muslim women. I think there are a range of people who are facing discrimination, are facing exclusion, and some of the stories that were shared yesterday morning were really disappointing. For example, a woman that wears a full face covering or niqab was told that she would get the keys to her state house if she took off her face covering. Like, the guy stood there and says, you take that off and I'll give you the keys. And for this woman who was a single mum and in desperate need of housing, you know, that was awful. And she refused and, you know, had to struggle with trying to find space with friends and family until she could find something suitable. So those kinds of experiences are just not acceptable, and I think there's a lot of work to do in terms of anti-discrimination, training and representation and diversity within public service.
So what then would you like to see the government do to counter this and to reduce hate against minorities?
Well, just what I said there was that around training of public service staff, making sure they understand what the impact is and what it feels like, seeing more diversity and representation, not just at the ground level but in leadership, so that we can have systems and processes and service delivery that reflects what the community needs.
So is there also, do you think, a need for better education of the general population around culture and around how to treat people properly?
Oh, absolutely. And that was the piece that I did on, particularly around violent extremism online. And my presentation was quite graphic, but the reason I did that is I think that people don't understand just how awful some of this stuff is and how much of an impact it has, and then the link between what happens online and how it translates to violence offline. So, yes, people do need to understand that and do need work within wider communities to bring people together because, you know, this affects so many people. And if we want a society where people are safe, then we need to be working on these grassroots issues of bringing communities together.
Specifically, how then do you think that the internet and social media impact the attitudes of hate towards minorities?
Well, one of the ways is through the use of algorithms, so that when you like or click something, the things that are recommended to you have been known to cause people to move into more radical and extreme views. The type of misinformation and disinformation, deliberate campaigns designed to provide false information are also impacting people. And that ability to create your bubble then, because, for example, if you do a Google search, it won't give you the wide range of information. It will only give you information that they think you'll click on. So we do need audits of algorithms and the way that works. We also need to think about how we regulate the online space. And to me, we need independent statutory authorities to do that. I wouldn't trust government. I think we need to have statutorily independent bodies to think about these issues and to action them. And also, again, use the education piece and the ability to speak back to some of this material.
So if then the algorithms and everything, it allows discourse between extremist views around the world, do you think that this is something that should just be undertaken by New Zealand, or is it something that social media companies and governments internationally should be trying to resolve?
Yes, New Zealand on its own, you know, would have little impact, and that's why, you know, my involvement with the Christchurch Call, and I'm one of the co-chairs of the advisory network there, these kind of multi-stakeholder international efforts are really important. And I think to a large extent, many of the major companies recognise the issue, that public pressure from governments and communities for them to act is important. But also governments have not always been exemplary. We've seen them ban social media companies, we've seen them trying to access information that should be private, and so on. So that's where having civil society organisations is really important, to ensure that our human rights are upheld, to ensure that whatever measures are put in place help and not harm.
That was the Islamic Women's Council's Anjul Rahman speaking about the recent anti-terrorism hui.
Thanks, Louis. And now we're joined by our news team, Connor Nell, who is also one of our resident petrolheads, to talk about electric vehicles. Connor, you have been quite vocal on the subject for a wee bit.
I have, yeah. I think I've kind of gone, because I saw the government legislation that's the proposal that's just been announced about giving a buyback to, essentially a sort of subsidy towards new electric vehicle purchases, and I think it's a really, really good idea, because what it shows to me is Labour is matching where the car market is going at the moment. More and more manufacturers are bringing out electric models. It's clear that other countries are bringing in legislation to try and, in the long term, phase out internal combustion. So, you know, it is developing technology. It is still very much in its early days. There's a lot of development and a lot more infrastructure that needs to be built. It's a good start. I like it.
We just had a caller that called in right at the start of the show. He said he's concerned that bringing this incentive in, well, indeed will bring more electric vehicles, but in, what, 2 decades down the line, we will be scratching our heads with a waste problems to figure out how are we supposed to dispose of all the petrol vehicles that we don't want. And don't forget, there aren't a lot of electric EVs available on the market right now. If you go log on to TradeMe, it's just Nissan Leafs over and over.
Yeah, and these are issues that this is new developing technology. These are issues that in terms of not only just battery disposal, but also battery life, the life of the car. I think I've heard projections before that, you know, the average life of a car like a Nissan Leaf, you know, is it's still considerably shorter than an internal combustion car can last. It's usually about 10, 12 years before the battery really gives up the ghost. And, you know, so... These are development issues that need to be worked out. But I think, you know, this is we've got to think about this in the long term, that manufacturers are releasing more. If you go to any motor show, all the concept cars pretty much EVs. You know, the motor industry has made it very, very clear that's where the future is. And so it's really up to government to actually prepare for that. And for people like me who are into cars, you only need to look at the Porsche Taycan, which is Porsche's new electric vehicle, as an example of what an electric vehicle can be when it appeals to people who like driving. And so I think we're going to see a shift in the next decade or so where electric vehicles move from just being white goods like Nissan Leafs that are just sort of A to B machines to actually being desirable vehicles that you want to go and buy. Cars that make you go for...
But so far, judging on what's available on the market, would you two guess an EV right now?
I would, as a commuter box, just... But my ideal two-car garage would be, you know, an EV to get through traffic every single day into Auckland and then have a big turbo or V8 monster sitting in the garage for weekends. Because I think the most, as a petrol head, the most depressing thing is wasting petrol on a really lovely car just sitting in traffic and letting it idle on the motorway. Well, why would you not, if you could, why would you not save that petrol for, you know, blasting about in the countryside at legal speeds?
I am not sure whether I'd buy one. I don't think I have the money. I think if you look on TradeMe, it's what, 60 grand for a secondhand electric vehicle? And that's, you're going to be spending, what, 10k max on a secondhand?
Yeah, $8,000. That doesn't really do much if you want to buy a decent, more decent, like more reliable brands, because a lot of them are just BMWs, top end brands like Tesla, BMWs, or like what Connor said, yeah, Porsches.
And I think that's going to be the challenge of the motor industry, is, you know, how to bring the costs down, how to make them a viable purchase for sort of everyday family. But I think as well, you know, it's worth saying too, that even if you don't own an electric vehicle, there are things you can do even with your petrol car to drive economically as well and do your bit for the environment, such as short shifting, driving without the aircon on, you know, driving with the windows up. All of that stuff contributes to reducing your carbon footprint and reducing your fuel consumption. You know, a huge part of it is your driving style as well. So if you are an environmentally conscious motorist, look into those tactics about how to drive a bit more fuel efficiently.
We just have a text came in saying Leaf is the worst example. Most new EVs have very low battery capacity reduction. Yeah, but I think another problem right now for people who wants to get into the EV market is recharging, because if you like flat shares or live in a house that doesn't have a garage, or you are forced to park on the road, there is very little way of recharging your car, I guess.
And I think that's what you know, needs to be understood. This is going to take we're on a good start at the moment with having EV charging places in a lot of public spaces, but this is going to take a huge infrastructure investment to get it to the point where EVs are like petrol cars as commonplace.
Do you think we should have the infrastructure installed first before rolling out the rebate?
I think the rebate is still a good start. I think it's going to be led by this is going to be a dual effort by the government and the motor industry. The government encouraging the motor industry, and the motor industry, through that encouragement, putting in investment into their products. Once the product's there, people will buy it. And once people buy it, the demand for that infrastructure will come. Once that demand comes, it should get built. So it will really be the government. It will be government incentives and the motor industry market that will be having to drive this. And it seems to be happening already. People want EVs. Porsche, you know, Tesla are killing it. Porsche are killing it. VW, all these manufacturers are starting to get on the trend here. And doesn't seem like it's going to stop. you know.
Indeed. Well, let's keep our motor chat for bring this to a close for now instead of not turning this into Top Gear. But thanks very much, Connor, and we keep sending in your texts about electric vehicles, and we will, I don't know, maybe we'll respond to them later. And now, Louis got another story, this time also about the environment.
Irirangi Po, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
In 2019, the kakapo population reached a record high 219 individuals after a bumper breeding season, where 71 chicks survived to adulthood. Kakapo are now only found on three predator-free islands, including Codfish and Anchor Island, where breeding is closely monitored by the Department of Conservation. I spoke to the kakapo recovery team's Bronwyn Janes about the threats to kakapo breeding and how her team manages these. To start, I asked her what was predicted for the 2021-22 breeding season.
Having reviewed the development of Remu fruit on the Kakapo Islands, we are expecting breeding on the southern Kakapo Islands this coming summer. The fruit levels are not as high as the 2019 breeding season, so we're not expecting record-breaking levels of breeding, but we are expecting quite a big breeding season with over 50% of the females to breed. And hopefully that will mean they produce a lot of chicks and we will continue to see the population grow, and we're all very excited and keen to see how it goes.
So how many chicks of those that are born will survive to adulthood? What are the major threats to their survival?
So the percentage of survival does vary quite a lot. It's once they actually hatch, they have a good chance of surviving to adulthood, and most will make it. Our biggest loss is actually between is either that the eggs don't hatch or that they don't develop. So sometimes this can appear that they're infertile or that they stop developing it very early. But once they actually hatch, they have a very good chance of developing, of actually succeeding and going all the way through to adulthood. But our biggest things that we watch out for, either so some of the chicks develop like breathing issues, so we check on the chicks quite regularly to make sure that they're breathing really well. And we also sometimes have problems, especially on Fennel Ho, where the Remu fruit doesn't always ripen. And if the Remu fruit doesn't ripen, then the mums struggle to feed their chicks, especially if they've got multiple chicks in a nest. So we have to keep an eye on how much food is available and keep an eye on the weights of the chicks to help ensure that they pull through. And if mum's struggling to feed them, then that's a point where we will pull chicks out of a nest and hand rear just to get them through if mum can't find them enough food.
So in the 2019 season, there were obviously issues on Codfish Island with aspergillosis. What does this do? Is it still expected to be much of a threat?
So yeah, 2019 on Fennel Ho, we had an aspergillus outbreak, which is a fungal lung infection that we had in the birds. Aspergillus is a fungus that is literally everywhere all of the time. And we don't yet understand why it suddenly became an issue in 2019, whether it was a really strong strain of aspergillus or whether there was an underlying health issue that the birds had or whether it was just the stress of the breeding season that made them more susceptible to it. It's literally something that you're going to be breathing in every minute of every day and then constantly exposed to, and usually it causes no problems. So there's a lot of work happening with scientists and researchers all around the world to try and understand what happened in 2019. So we don't know whether we will see it again. We have a lot of plans to help control it and to hopefully get on top of it quicker than we did last time if it does rear its head. But we've never seen it as an issue as it turned up in 2019 before. So we suspect that there was something specific last year. And that we're unlikely to see those same specific things come together again, but we are working on defining it.
What role does technology play in breeding and survival, especially with recovery for aspergillosis?
So technology plays a huge role for the kakapo in terms of breeding and monitoring them. So every kakapo wears a transmitter. which provides them with like a unique radio signal, essentially, so we can track them. Those transmitters also record activity levels. So on the males, they record if they've mated and then check for any other transmitters in the area, and so they can tell us exactly which female they've mated with, how long they mated for, and give a quality for that mating as well, so we know who they mated with and whether it was likely to be a successful mating or not. The females' transmitters track their activity levels and tell us whether they've started nesting or not, which then allows us to go and find the nests and do things like egg candling and check on the nests and make sure that they've picked a good nest site that's warm and dry. We also use, we're using more and more technology to remotely monitor the birds, so we can actually see these activity levels, where the birds have been, what they've been up to in terms of nesting or breeding, whereabouts they've been on the islands, without actually having to go out and physically track in on them or collect the data from their transmitters using radio telemetry. So it all comes down to computers via a system we call Norinet. We also use a lot of technology to manage the feeding of the birds as well, since the birds have to be in really good nick to breed, but you also don't want the females to be too fat, otherwise they produce majority male chicks. So we have smart feeders that only open for the right bird, allocated to most of the birds on the islands, and so the birds can access appropriate levels of food to fuel them through a breeding season. The technology in terms of aspergillosis it's not so much tech, it's just lots of research and data. We did a lot of collection of samples and bloods and health results and samples from all across the island, so there's a lot of research happening into it rather than tech.
On a slightly other note, do you think that climate change will impact breeding patterns much? What do you expect this to change?
So the kakapo are reliant on rimu masting, at least down here in the south. That's what we know triggers kakapo breeding. And for a rimu tree to mast, produce a mass lot of fruit, they rely on a pattern of hot and cold years prior to producing fruit. So if there's a hot summer in year one followed by a cold summer in year two, the rimu trees will pollinate in the summer of year three and then set fruit for a mast season in the summer of year four. And so climate change is likely to influence the temperature fluctuations we see, how hot, how cold it is each summer. We might see things that are more extreme, which is going to influence our rimu masting. It might mean that we end up with rimu masts more regularly if we do have more extreme temperatures, but we also see that severe winters pass after the pollination stage for rimu can result in a lot of fruit falling off the trees, and then we don't end up with a big mast the following summer, even though the fruit started to develop, it's all come off and it can't finish developing. And so the changes to either rimu masting regularity or causing masts to be smaller are going to impact on kakapo and their ability to breed successfully.
That was the Kakapo Recovery Team's Bronwyn Janes speaking about her team's predictions for the 2021-22 kakapo breeding season.
Thanks very much, Louis. You tuned in to the Thursday Wire with me, Justin Wong, and Louis McAllister on 95 BFM. It's just past 1:15. We will be going on another break before heading off to Australia. Stay tuned.
Definitely. How can you go past a garden city?
Hard to find a good butler.
Hamilton, city of the future, the rest of you will never catch up.
Oh dear.
And it's great for dairy-free options?
True. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Shaky Isles Coffee. Brewed different for entree enjoyers and hometown heroes. Go to shakyisles.co.nz.
Elemental Nights presents Mara TK. Friday, July 16th at Titirangi War Memorial Hall.
We put the middle finger up to heaven. We said all of that shit.
One of the most in-demand voices in the world of future soul and modern beats, the idiosyncratic Electric Wire Hustle frontman is performing live for one night only. Mara TK, live at Titirangi War Memorial Hall, Friday, July 16th. Get your tickets now from elementalfestival.co.nz or Moshtix.
It's music.
95 BFM.
Don't cry, just...
BFM, the original originator. Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
This week on Neighbourhood Watch, locals near the 12 Apostles in southwest Victoria are angry at a federal government decision to approve oil and gas exploration within 5 kilometres of the tourist site. But first, I talked to Radio Adelaide's Zoe Canandes about the minimum wage going up in Australia.
So the Fair Work Commission announced a 2.5% increase in the minimum wage, which is pretty exciting, I guess. So the minimum wage has increased to $20.33 per hour. What increases in some COVID-affected industries have been delayed to 3 to 5 months. So this will take the minimum wage for Australia's lowest paid workers to, as I mentioned, $20.33, which kind of equates to $772.60 for a full-time worker, which is, it essentially adds up to about $18.80 a week more for the Australia's lowest paid full-time workers. The Fair Work Commission President, Justice Ian Ross, said that this year's economic circumstances were very difficult to those at the time of last year's 1.75% minimum wage increase, which was at the height of the pandemic. The peak union body, the ACTU, has been pushing for at least a 3.5% minimum wage rise, whilst many employer groups have been arguing for a smaller increase than that was delivered. I guess naturally they would be. The Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry have been arguing for a 1.1% pay increase, describing a 2.5% pay raise as premature and irresponsible. It said that the wage rise would cost $3.6 billion. And while most of its big business members were, you know, currently doing quite well, of its small business members were still struggling, obviously, after COVID. We've seen small businesses hit the hardest. I think that is definitely across the board. It's also pointed out that there's nearly a third of those who get the minimum wage and award wage increases work in retail, food, accommodation sectors, and those people were so affected by the lockdown last year. Sitting between workers and employer demands, you know, people have said that the decision was pretty much as expected. Some people have said if you look at history of decisions from the Fair Work Commission, they usually have a good track record in making projections on how wages are likely to move and what's a responsible increase. But obviously we know that, and respectfully we know that more could have been given, and a good track record doesn't mean you're always getting something right. So we've seen a larger increase than what employers wanted, which I suppose is a good thing. And it'll be interesting to see the further rhetoric that comes from this.
For us who don't really know, does the minimum wage apply all across the country, or just all different states have their own minimum wage levels?
The minimum wage applies to the entire country. It's sort of it's announced this time each year because this is sort of post-budget world that we're living in.
Okay. Moving on to the second topic of the day, there has been backlash against the possibility of gas exploration near the 12 Apostles Rock in Geelong, in Victoria.
Yeah, locals are absolutely furious about this one, a federal government decision to open an area within 5 kilometres of Victoria's 12 Apostles. They've done this for offshore gas and oil exploration. I'm sure you all know the 12 Apostles, a very iconic landscape in Australia that obviously we don't want to see destroyed by gas and oil and big billion-dollar companies that can just do whatever they want. Bidding opened on the latest offshore exploration area of 21 sites off the coast of Victoria and Western Australia. The closest to shore follows the coast between Port Campbell and Geelong, which is in southwest Victoria. The home, again, is home to the Great Ocean Road and tourist attractions, including Wreck Beach, Loch A, Gorge and 12 Apostles. In 2019, there were more than 100 Port Campbell residents. They gathered in the heart of the town. It was a population of 500 to protest against the deep sea drilling in the Great Australian Bight. They said that they were completely baffled by the announcement. It is, again, a very clumsy move by the federal government to increase our gas and oil importation or funds or whatever. But again, it's at the risk of these really beautiful landscapes and environments and places that are so cherished by so many people. The federal government, it's hard to imagine really why they've done this, but they have.
But did the locals say what could have caused to the 12 Apostles rocks themselves if the oil and gas exploration went underway?
We don't know exactly what will happen per se, but we do know places like Australia's Great Barrier Reef, for example, that is very much dying at the hands of big companies for mining and gas and oil, and we've seen it before, and I think people are scared because we've seen really cherished areas of the country diminish because of these people and these companies, and I think there is just a massive fear and mistrust to the government in regards to these situations.
That was Neighbourhood Watch Ripper.
That was The Wire.
Ko rā te hota ka katoa mō tēnei rā. That's all for the Thursday Wire today. Nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero me ki a mātou mō tēnei rā. Thanks to those who spoke to us today. We had Health Minister Andrew Little, Radio Adelaide Zoe Canandes, the Kakapo Recovery Team's Bronwyn Jeans, and the Islamic Women's Council Andrew Rahman. Ka hoki mai mātou a te rā wiki. We will be back next week, and a huge thanks to my producer Louis McAllister as well. Enjoy the rest of the week. Mā te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.